on this edition of The Self-Publishing Show.
What suspense really is hooking that reader into asking the most fundamental story question of all, which is, what happens next?
Publishing is changing. No more gatekeepers, no more barriers, no one standing between you and your readers. Do you want to make a living from your writing? Join indie bestseller Mark Dawson and first-time author James Blatch as they shine a light on the secrets of self-publishing success. This is The Self-Publishing Show. There's never been a better time to be a writer.
Hello and welcome to The Self-Publishing Show. It's a Friday. Of course, it's me, James Blatch.
And me, Mark Dawson.
And today, Mark,
we are
out of our sheds in our garden. We're in front of the great public. We are at a live recording in front of an audience at NINC 2022.
I think they passed the test.
I think the microphones are working because my ears are now bleeding from that. Fantastic to have you all here. It's so exciting. I know lots of people listen to the podcast, but actually it is possible for us to never really know that because we sit by ourselves recording it. Tom and John are here, and there's another team behind them who all helped to get this podcast out every week. So it's really lovely for us to be on the road. And fingers crossed, some of this equipment might work and everyone will actually see this next week. If you're just looking at a blank screen now, that's my fault. Okay, right. Mark, we have two guests in this show. We have got Dave Chesson, who's a familiar voice on the podcast over the years. Over the how many years we've been doing this?
Six, I think 350 episodes. Never missed a week.
Never missed a week, 350 well, episodes.
You haven't missed a week. I missed one or two weeks.
Oh, did you? Yeah.
New York,
yes. Tom stepped in for you and he was brilliant. So good he has not been back in front of the camera. Bless him. And Julia Spencer-Thomas. So I always knew, is it Spencer-Thomas? Did I get that right?
Spencer-Fleming.
Spencer-Fleming. I know someone called Spencer-Thomas, which is really annoying for remembering names. Julia, I said to you in advance that we'll pick Dave, we want to talk to Dave, lots going on, he's got fingers in lots of pies, always an interesting bloke to talk to, but I always knew that there's this one session that people come out of and say, that was a brilliant session, so let's save that slot, and that's going to be Julia in the second half of the show. Okay, do we have any more witty banter, which is what we're famous for?
I can't force banter. Banter just either comes or doesn't go. Usually our banter is James waffles on for 5 minutes, says something stupid, and then I tell him he said something stupid. And that's basically the basis of our relationship over the last 10 years.
Yeah, basically, I put myself out there, you know, I fall down for comedy, and he sits there looking all smart. Okay, I tell you what we'll do before we talk to Dave, let's talk about the conference. So we're here at NINC. We go to a few conferences a year. We used to go to Thriller Fest, we go to 20 Books in Vegas, I've been to 20 Books Madrid this year. And here we are at NINC. Now, I hate to say we have a favourite conference because we love Craig Martell, all the work he does with 20 Books, but I do kind of have a favourite conference for a variety of reasons, not least the beach, and that is NINC. I think it's a fabulous conference.
Yeah, I think I can't remember how many times I've been there. I think the first time I ever spoke at a conference was at NINC in this room in, I think it was 2015, which is an awfully long time ago. So I think we missed last year because we couldn't fly. And we missed.
We had tickets. We had air tickets and tickets for NINC.
And we missed the year before that because I think there was only 20 people here that year. So that was when we were all kind of locked down. But apart from that, I haven't missed one, I don't think.
No.
And it's been, it's great. It's a lovely conference. It's, I wouldn't say small. It's medium sized, 400 people this time, I think. And there's an intermediate to advanced conference. So the questions are occasionally challenging, which is good. Keeps you on your toes. And it's in a lovely, lovely part of the world. I mean, the weather this week has been really hot. I had dinner with, I had lunch with BookBub this afternoon and stupidly sat with my back facing the sun. I was drenched at the end of it. It was very unappetizing. But anyway, lovely to see that.
Well, there aren't many conferences where you can go, as I did this afternoon, just go 100 yards and have a swim in a very warm Gulf of Mexico.
I saw a dolphin today.
Yes, so did I.
Did you?
Yes, in the shallows.
Yeah.
Did you see it? It must have been the same one. Mm. Yeah. I think his name is David Dolphin. yes. So that's good. So the beach makes it good. But I completely agree. I think obviously I've been coming here pre being a writer, struggling to try and become a writer. And now I'm a writer. And so now I can sit in on the sessions with a little bit more knowledge of what's going on, and I agree that the level's a little bit up here, which is great for Nick. Okay, right, shall we have our first guest?
Why not?
So please welcome to the stage your friend and mine, Mr. Dave Chesson. Dave, look, thank you very much indeed for coming onto the show. You are no stranger to the show. We've had you on several times, and during the time we've known you, you've gone, for the people who don't know Dave, a bit of a data geek, I think you probably wouldn't mind being called that.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, definitely. I really love to dig in and try to explore and figure out exactly what the markets are doing. You know, I just, coming from an engineer background and everything, I was like, man, you know, what can I as an author do to get Amazon to notice me and to show my book, as well as what kind of tests can I do? And so that's just driven me right down that process.
Yeah, and your main product, I suppose you're famous for, which used to be called Kindle, is now Publish Drive, is that right?
Published completely wrong. Kindle Rocket, and then
yeah, it's Rocket. Do you know the word Rocket would not come into my head then?
Exactly. So, yeah. So created Publisher Rocket. We changed the name because we started talking to Barnes and Noble, iTunes, and Kobo, and you know they just don't like it when the name of the thing is called KDP Rocket. It was like, so we were like, okay, touche. So we made that pivot, and that's really opened up a lot more discussions. And we're still working on a bunch of things that are going to be coming out in the future that I'm really excited about because. Well, I mean, I love Amazon. It's given us so many opportunities. KDP was a great program, but truth be told is that there are a lot of other markets and they're really anxious to gain more of that ground. And I think as authors need to understand that and prepare.
Yeah, and in simple terms, if we can simplify this, it's the place to go, your products is the place to go to work out what categories your book should be in. And you can even go all the way back and look at the data that you can access through that product and work out what categories you should be writing for.
Absolutely. And you can choose your keywords, but we have a lot of really cool features that are going to be coming out very soon. So the category system itself already has, you know, all 14,000 plus Amazon categories in it. But what I'm really excited about is very soon we're going to be able to tell, you can click on any one of those categories and you'll be able to know the percentage of books in that categories that are actually in big publishers or self-published. You'll be able to look at the percentage of books that are KU or not. And then later on in the year, we're going to come out with historical category information, which means you can then look at that category and you can see sales trends. You can see how well it's performing, the amount of competition inside of it, and more. So it's just been really cool. I can't wait till everybody gets to see that.
And tell me about the company size. So you're based near Nashville, I think.
Yes.
And where's the work go on for Publish Drive?
Well, you know, in order to be able to create something like that, it's honestly a huge endeavor because first off, we do have the US market inside of Publisher Rocket, but we also have the German and the UK, and we're working with others. But we can't just open up those markets because in order to analyze that kind of information and help authors to truly know what's going on in it, we have to work with publishing companies, we have to work with established organizations so as to make sure the analysis inside our tool is getting the right information. And so we have that. Also, our support team is full of writers. And matter of fact, we want to make sure that our support covers all areas. So that way, if somebody, say, is on the other side of the world, they still get an answer really quickly. So truth be told, I've never actually like marked down all the different countries that are represented inside the organization, but there's a lot.
Yeah. We had lunch with BookBub today, as you mentioned earlier, and they try to employ writers as well. Naturally, I think they end up with writers, which is a double-edged sword because quite often they become successful and leave because they become full-time writers, which happens, which is kind of a good thing, right? But
that is true. But it's also great too to have writers be a part of support. Because they can write really good detailed responses. Sometimes a little too much information, okay, you know, but.
Yeah. Don't need a novel.
No,
just need to know how to turn it off. Okay. The other product you're becoming known for is called Atticus. And many of us are, well, people still write in Word or whatever, but a lot of us write in Scrivener. And we've always had a slight pain point at the end of your Scrivener time. I do love Scrivener. I like to move everything about. Is then, 9 times out of 10, an editor is going to ask for it in Word, probably at Times New Roman, double spaced, you know, whatever requirements they have. So you output it to Word. And then that becomes your manuscript, right? It doesn't matter what happens in Scrivener anymore because that's the live one, that's marked up. And that's fiddly, I think, and keeping a track of that. So I think you saw that pain point.
Absolutely, yeah. The story that really kickstarted off was I used to write in Scrivener. And then I would export to Word, and we'd go back and forth with the editor. And the funny thing is, I would always name my files, you know, final.
Yeah.
And then all caps final. And then this is the final, final, final. Yeah. And the craziest part is, I would never delete because I was worried that, okay, maybe I need to revert back or something like that. So by the end of it, I have 8 different final copies. Well, I once published a book where I picked what I thought was the final. I think I titled it like, "This is the final, stupid," or something like that. And I sent it off to a formatter. Formatter paid all this money, got it, uploaded it onto Amazon, and realized that the edits for the last couple of chapters were not in that version. And while I would like to say that I'm a really good writer, I know the importance of a really good editor. And so I got a little destroyed on the reviews. And so it's just that file management has always been a real big problem. And the other thing we writers do is that when we look at book writing software, right, we think about just writing. But the truth is something that is a good book writing software, it needs to be something that helps you to organize, to write. It should also help you to collaborate. And more importantly, it should help you to format it into a book, which turns it from just writing something to a book itself. And we authors have to go through so many different pieces of software. You know, like you said, you go from Scrivener to Word to a formatting software of some sort, and you have to learn these three. And so my goal with Atticus was to create one software where an author would never have to leave. They could manage everything right from the one spot. They could learn just one and really master it instead of having to be a master of many. And so when we launched Atticus, we thought we would start with formatting first. Because every author at some point needs to format it into their ebook and print book. And there's some great software out there. One in particular has made it incredibly easy for authors to be able to effectively and efficiently turn something into a professional book. But it was limiting because it only worked on Mac, and that was Vellum. And the other thing is that there were a lot of features that we figured that we could really add to that. So we started off with that. And so we made Atticus work on all computers. Okay, so you can do it on Mac. You can do it on PC, Chromebook, you can even put it on your iPad. It technically right now works on an iPhone, but my team needs to go through and make it look better. But my goal with that is that an author can whip out any device they have, access their books, work on them when they're ready, and be good to go. And so we focused on the formatting, and it's only 147 lifetime, okay? And that's for print and ebooks. That makes it over $100 cheaper than one of the competitors. And we're adding new features just about every day. And so those new features are free upgrades. So we've hit formatting, and we're gonna round, there's a couple more things we wanna add. But the other thing that's really cool about it is that it's also designed to be written in. So it's not just a formatting software. So you can open it up and you can start writing your book, and we have a lot of tools. But right now my team is really gonna be adding a lot more coming up very soon so that you can have character cards, you can have plotting, you can pull in plotting information from other plotting software, because let's face it, we authors are very particular about how we plot. Nobody's gonna get it right. There's a lot of flavors. And there's gonna be analysis, there's gonna be tools, everything. And kind of a good way to kind of explain how we're gonna approach our writing is, it's Scrivener, but you don't need a course to learn how to use it. And so then at that point, once we have that done, we'll add the collaboration component. And what this will allow an author to do is that you can write your book, and when you're ready, you can send a link to your editor. And the editor doesn't have to own Atticus, they can open it up, and we're gonna design it for them to look and feel just like Word. Because let's face it, editors really prefer that layout. Now there's a couple of things, we've talked to a whole bunch of editors on what they would like to see inside of it, and we're gonna make it like a better tool, you know, based off of their decision. And so when the editor starts working on that book, the author can see it right there in their Atticus. And then they can accept the changes, and that gets applied to their book. But my favorite thing about collaboration is that when you're done, you can literally remove that person's access. So you can collaborate with other writers, editors, art team and beta, and formatters. You can bring them in with certain permissions. And then when they're done, say your beta readers, you can just click, 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 and they no longer have access. So now you as an author have control of where your book is, you know who has what permission, and then you can remove that when ready. And so once we have that out, that would allow an author to be able to start, write, collaborate, and format, and never have to leave never have to have multiple file formats and never have to have a file that says, this is the final, stupid.
Yeah. Yeah, that's amazing. And the collaboration, I think, is really exciting. So if I've got this right, goes off to your copy editor, for instance, you can see the changes they're making, and you can be working behind them, accepting the changes, not accepting them, making your own changes, sort of seeing them going forward. So speeding up the process, you don't have to wait 3 weeks for them to give the whole manuscript back with one or two small changes.
So this is why it's super important to meet with the editors, right? And we've gotten a lot of feedback from them. First off, a lot of editors said, hey, I'm not really sure I'd like it if the writer can see the chapter I'm working on at that moment. And what if, you know, like, I don't want them to stop me while I'm working on something. So we're actually going to have in there that, in this case, the editor can work on a chapter, and when they're finished with the chapter and they're ready for the author to be able to check out and accept or whatever, they can clear it. So then the author can go in there and work on it. But also, too, we're going to make it that if that's really important to the author, the owner of Atticus, that that's the case, then they can work that out with the editor, and they do have the ability to turn that permission off. So the key thing to the collaboration is that when you go to select either to work with another writer or an editor, there will be a window that pops up, and you can choose the kind of permissions or the way you guys work together. And I think that's the best way to have a team, you know, with you and your editor, and to have that collaboration work effectively and efficiently.
You see yourself using a collaborative tool like that?
No, probably not. It's a good idea. I think it's great that there's lots of different options. But I've written 40 books now, so I have a very set procedure.
He's aiming at the younger generation. Actually, I mean, I think that is a good question. You've come up with a good product, okay, and it's going to be a useful product, and I used it myself. How do you turn that into something that becomes a household name in self-publishing?
Yeah, well, you know, it's kind of like what we did with Publisher Rocket. Regardless of when we hit all those moments, like, I have a full team of 8 full-time, full-stack developers working around the clock, and we're going to constantly be working to add and improve. Publisher Rocket's been out for 7 years, and even today, we're still the whole thing we talked about with the categories. It's like, as an author, I'm constantly looking at things and saying, man, wouldn't it be nice if, like, I would love to know the percentage of books in a certain category that are KU or not KU. That might help me to make a decision. You know, if I'm thinking about writing in a category and I don't know if I should or shouldn't, that's a good number. And so I just turned to my team. I'm like, guys, we got to figure this out. Let's do it. Honestly, that took us 6 months to figure out, because it's not easy. There's millions of books. How do you do that? Especially since Rocket is a one-time fee, because I personally don't like subscriptions. So how do we as a company do that so that it's not costing us oodles amounts of money and yet make it so that it's really accurate? So it takes time. But I truly believe that, you know, there's so many ways to improve. And since we don't have like one-off workers or one program or any programmer or anything like that, it's going to allow us to not only continue to make it better, but to pivot as the industry changes. I mean, just look at what happened with the Mobi files. You know, Amazon used to say that that was the file of choice. Now they don't accept it. But then they're like, oh no, in order to send it to a Kindle, it's got to be a Mobi. Oh, okay. You know, we as tools and software really have to be prepared to pivot and adapt to the changes, you know, in the marketplace. And I think that's what really makes kind of a product grow and grow. And as more people use it and they put their books on there and they've enjoyed it, that word gets out and more use it. And like I said, I think at one point we'll be, you know, we hope to add more that makes it a great product or project management tool for authors. Imagine you have a couple of books you're working on, bring in an editor here, bring in a formatter there, like, and you can see the progress of all of your projects on one screen. I think that would be great for medium to small publishing companies as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's the secret to staying agile and being able to pivot. I mean, Amazon is so large now that I think they find it very difficult to make changes. I think you can still upload Word documents, can't you, instead of Mobis? And I think they still have that. Because if they turned it off, there'd be someone somewhere, or 10,000 people somewhere, be bereft. But I can't imagine uploading a Word document. It's my final document, my book, but there you go. Dave, thank you so much. You've had a good week here at NINC.
Oh, it's been amazing. Yeah, NINC is one of my favorites to go to as well, because you get to hit a lot of the advanced topics. And like you were saying too, you've got these really incredible questions, and You don't have to start off by defining what an Amazon bestseller rank is, or you can really get into the nitty gritty. And it's also great because after the events, there's a lot of time to talk with other authors, and I've learned a lot. It's really cool to hear what's happening and what people are doing. So it's just an amazing event in that respect.
Super. Thank you very much indeed, Dave Chesson. Your technical task now is to unplug yourself from your chest. Leave the microphone on the... You can take your water. And thank you very much, Dave. I love the way, look, he's dual wielding with his microphones like he's in a video game, pointing them at the audience. Well done. Well done, young Tom. Okay, our next guest is one of the speakers. Yes, it's you. It's you, Julia. One of the speakers this week and did a couple of fabulous sessions, very well received. We want to talk craft because we come here to learn marketing, but we also come here to learn craft. And one of the things I like about these conferences, particularly in Inc, is it doesn't matter whether you're traditionally published or indie published or however you write it on the side of a tree, it's writing, right? And story is story, and getting people to turn the page is the key thing for most of us. And I think, Julia, that is what you've been talking about this week.
Yeah, actually, I'm from Maine, and we do, in fact, write all of our books on trees there. And then you have to convert it to, from a woody to something else.
Yes, a woody. it doesn't matter.
Okay. Okay, well, we'll move on from that. See, I'm good at banter, so.
There you go.
Fundamentally, you can market up the wazoo, of course, but if you are not creating an experience for your readers that makes them want to dive into your fictional world and turn the pages and get to that last page and say, oh my gosh, I can't wait to read the next book by this author, you're not going to take off.
I think that's fundamental, actually. Someone asked me this week what the secret was for what was the secret to get someone to, to continue through a series and to buy more books? And I said to them, I'm fairly confident I could use digital advertising to sell the first book of anything. Doesn't matter what the quality is. I can sell you, if the cover's decent, the blurb's decent, I can probably sell that to a reader. But at that point, my job as a marketer becomes much less important because it's then my job as a craftsman, as an author, because if the book's no good, it doesn't matter how good my advertising is, the reader's never going to buy the second book.
Yeah, ultimately, what sells the book? The book sells the book. So I've been here talking specifically about two aspects that are kind of condensed versions of seminars that I have given teaching an MFA course. One has been about using setting and landscape to really anchor your reader in the fictional world. John Gardner famously calls it falling into the fictional dream. You want to hold out your hand and have the reader place their hand in yours, and you're going to say, trust me, I'm not going to lead you astray. You are going to believe that you are, a Cold War aviator. And what is one of the ways that we get our readers to trust us? It's getting those details right. But on the other hand, we don't want to write, and I'm going to apologize if you write techno-thrillers, I haven't read your James. We don't want to do 5 pages of a description the wing of a one certain type
of plane. I would read that, yeah. But I don't write.
Okay. Yeah, my husband loved those books. What we want to do is to be able to focus on the setting and the scene in a couple of different ways. First and foremost, we use it to define character. Different people notice different things. Someone who has never seen an aircraft before is going to have a completely different experience looking at that than someone who is an aviator. Someone who is, a Mainer who has come to the beach in Florida is noticing different things than the guys on the beach who were laying out those fabulous cabanas that we had the chance to go into. So being able to look at your landscape through the eyes of your character keeps you focused on the few important details that ground your reader in reality, but also don't waste that description. Your description should also be revealing the character and moving the plot forward.
Yeah, so there's got to be, as you say, that balance, and I think that's a key thing. We've talked to Jenny Nash, very similar, and mm-hmm. she's a big proponent of this as well. And one of the things when I was writing my book, I was very motivated by Top Gun. I love Top Gun. I think it's a great story, told really well, grabbed everybody back in its day. Not the new one necessarily, but the old one. And I read quite a lot about the writing of that. And one of the things they did with that is they used the aviation language of the day without explaining it. So if you watch that original Top Gun, they talk about this bogey's all over me. I'm going to Angels 14. And they talk in a language that only really means something to people who know that. And a lot of films that are less confident, I think, would feel the need to do the kind of labored, what was it, Back to the Future, it's your brother, Chuck, it's your brother, Martin Berry, you know. Do what Stephen King says, trust your audience. Yeah. Throw that stuff in, because that becomes atmospheric and it becomes part of the scenery, which I think is what you're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, generally speaking, those terms, you don't actually need to know what a bogey is, and you can get it under context. If there's an enemy, you know, fighter coming towards you, I guess that's the bogey. I do believe in trusting your reader. And also giving them, again, those particular sort of details that put them in the scene without slowing the action down.
You can be over-descriptive, right?
It can be over-descriptive. One thing that we talked about in the workshop was you can use description to help with your pacing. So I gave an example of my current work in progress where the hero, who is a cop, is on a mountain in the Adirondacks, and he is he's searching through there. And so I slowed the description down and I used short rhythmic sentences to give, hopefully subliminally, the effect of someone walking. And I slowed it down. I increased the depth of description I was using because I wanted to stretch that out to ramp up the suspense. So when he finds a booby trap alarm, it becomes shocking and a lovely twist for the reader to get into.
Yeah. And I think that comes on to the other area you've been talking about, which is pacing. And always having something to...
Right, always is pacing in... I did my second workshop this morning on suspense. And, of course, suspense is, I think, often misunderstood. You know, people hear suspense and they think, oh, it's a thriller. You know, I write small town cozy. I write romance. And the example that I taught with that everybody knows is Cinderella. Because what suspense really is hooking that reader into asking the most fundamental story question of all, which is, what happens next? At the end of every scene, at the end of every chapter, we want those readers saying, what happens next? And so in Cinderella, you know, we get to see how this classic fairy tale ramps up using escalating stakes. So the first stake that Cinderella has to do, she's got a problem in front of her. Suspense always involves the protagonist who's got a goal, and that goal is going to get frustrated. So she's got to sew her own dress. Did you see the Disney version? Actually, the mice help her out, which is kind of cheating, but she's got to sew her own dress so she can go to the ball. That's her goal. She meets that goal, but then her awful stepsisters tear the dress apart. Her goal has been frustrated. Now she's even worse off than she was before because now it's the night of the ball. The carriage is left. She's stuck there. And then her fairy godmother comes along. But now we've got another impediment. She's got a great dress. She's got mice who've turned into guys who are driving her pumpkin coach. But now there's a ticking clock. After midnight, that's it. The dress disappears. The coach turns into a moldy pumpkin. So she's got to get there, you know, do her thing with the prince, and then get out again. And then she's back home, and now the stakes have ramped up even higher because he loves her, she loves him. We're not gonna go into the detail of falling in love with someone over the course of 2 hours of dance, but.
Come on, we can be romantic.
Yeah, okay. But now she's locked up in the attic. It's the biggest stumbling block of all. And at this point, the stakes are so high. If she can't get out of the attic and meet, you know, try on that slipper and meet the prince, she loses the whole ball of wax. And one of the reasons I like to use this example is because Cinderella's not risking life or limb. You know, at no point is she in physical danger. I mean, her stepmother's mean. Maybe she's going to get housemaid's knee eventually. But, you know, she's got food. She's got shelter. Nothing's going to blow up. She's not going to sink into the, you know, quicksand. But the suspense is there because a protagonist that we care about wants something desperately and has to keep overcoming a series of obstacles that even when she conquers them, still lead her down into a place where she has to have another obstacle to be conquered.
Yeah, and when you put it like that, it sounds simple, doesn't it? That's the when people say, I couldn't put the book down, that's what they're talking about because they're invested and they need to know. So I'll take questions in it, by the way. If you've got some questions you wanna just let young Tom know over there and he'll be racing towards you in a moment. We do, some writers talk about writing their protagonists into an impossible situation and then seeing how they could write themselves out of it. And that's quite a good way of doing that, of always having that stake there. But can we overdo this? Can we constantly have a stake one after another,
yeah,
ratcheting up?
You absolutely can. I mean, if we're constantly ratcheting tension, it exhausts the reader. You know, it's like watching those movies that just, it's one thing immediately after the other. It's sooner or later, you've got to pause it and go in the kitchen and, you know, get something. We don't want our readers going into the kitchen to get anything. We want them sticking there with their nose in the book. So the normal progress of tension is, I always teach in scene. We start the scene, you have a goal, there's a conflict, and then there is a resolution. The resolution could be, you're solved, but now you have another question or something to do. It could be utter disaster. You know, Cinderella solved the problem and now her dress is in tatters. And it could be the reversal of disaster, which is an interesting way of playing on our storytelling sense because maybe things go really well. And we all know when things are going really well and you're not five pages away from the end of the book, something bad is coming down the line. So using scenes enables you to create a natural rhythm where you're rising, there's more tension, and then the reader gets a little breath. And then the next one is even higher tension, and then your reader gets another breath.
And I think when we chatted about this a couple of days ago, you talked about we very often have dual storylines in books that you can actually be clever and have as one going down, the other one starts coming up.
Yes, yeah. We often have, you know, what do you call it, the subplot or the B story or what have you. And very often, your B story is also going to have a protagonist who has got goals that the reader, the protagonist cares about, the reader's gonna care about, and they may be getting frustrated or advancing and questioning. So for instance, in my own books, the A story is always a mystery. I write mysteries. So we find out something, you know, someone's been shot. Well, that's actually the inciting incident, but, you know, and then at the end of the scene, the detective, the sleuth has an answer, but then that leads to more questions. It always leads to more questions. But my B story is the forbidden romance between the two protagonists. So when they are sitting, talking, thinking, planning their next move, that story ramps up. You know, maybe he catches her eye, or she notices the smell off of his hair. Now, that's cliched, I wouldn't do that, but you know, something like that, which gives the reader's experience kind of a height and a height and a height. So there's always tension pulling the reader into turning those pages, but you're not exhausting the reader because it's not all the same thing.
And this is the same for a small town romance or lit RPG or whatever genre?
Really, I mean, it's, you know, you've got in almost any sort of, you know, even a hard edge techno thriller, you have got personal stories going on as well. People are not, characters are not like pursuing their love lives necessarily while they're running from their, you know, for their lives and they're, you know, they've finally found the safe house in Budapest and shut the door. Okay, now you're in the safe house. Now we can have a scene where they are dealing with their personal lives. And of course, romance is a very easy one to point out, but it could be, you know, a daughter who is in conflict because her mother's always been cold to her and has never really felt accepted. It could be the son who is in conflict because his father wants him to take over the family business and he doesn't want to. It doesn't matter what it is, as long as protagonists that your readers care about want that goal. It's got to be the most important thing to them.
Okay, we've got a couple of minutes left. Are there any questions anybody would like to ask in the audience? It's got to be a question, surely, if Joe. They've been talked to out.
I've just covered everything you need to know about suspense. Boom,
It does, at this particular moment, it does feel like the last few seconds of a conference has lasted all week in the hot sun. Yeah. There is one question here. Come on, Tom, you've got to race over there. Come on, Tom, here you go. Look at him move. It's like a gazelle in the jungle.
See, his goal is, can he reach the microphone in time? It's a ticking clock.
And we need a camera on you. The camera's moving much slower and he's going the wrong way. So just one second, because we do have to film this and the camera is not a gazelle. The camera is a wildebeest. Roaming majestically across the plain.
He's not getting that urgency that keeps the suspense on.
No, exactly. Here we go.
So, Julia, how do you interweave the reader caring about the character with ramping up that suspense? So does that add to the suspense?
Suspense is really just a function of how much we care. It's our reaction as readers to how much we care about someone. And, you know, the example that I gave is, you think about right now, there's a war going on in Ukraine, and we're all concerned about it, we think about it, we read news articles about it, but now imagine how you would feel if your family was there, if your brother was behind enemy lines and you didn't know where he was or how he was or if he was alive. Right there. And that's just our human reaction. The goal is to make your readers care enough about those characters, you know, in the same way that they care about their family and their brother. Oh, I think I just hit my microphone.
Sorry, our sound engineer will be bleeding next door, but that's fine. Okay, look, Julia, thank you so much indeed for coming to talk to us today and being here in NINC. Have you enjoyed your week here?
It's been my first one. I've learned so much. There is so much that I've gotten as a traditionally published author that has just been amazing. Also, I've had about half my body weight in rum drinks, so that was a real good one, Jeff.
Okay, Julia, thank you very much indeed. Big round of applause. Well, we've come to the end of a big packed show. Just to let you know, we'll be recording the next one in Huntingdon and Salisbury in the UK next Friday, so if you could all make it over there, we'd like to be in your seats by 3 o'clock, please. This has been a bit different, isn't it?
Yeah, very different. Yeah, it's been a good week. Not finished yet because he's coming to the karaoke tonight. Apparently, Wayne has got the first song.
Who's singing at the karaoke tonight?
Where's
It's going to be quiet. Everybody's planning for somebody to go and do Sweet Caroline so we can all just shout sing along.
Okay.
Piano Man, there we go, we can do that. Okay, yeah, that will be fun tonight. We've got a dinner first, haven't we? Then
we do, yes. We're flying out tomorrow, and James has waited until Wednesday, not forgetting, but unfortunately for James, there's a hurricane coming in.
Yeah, so. I'm staying for the hurricane. It should be fun. So I may or may not be alive by Friday.
So it could be a solo show next week.
Yeah, it could be solo. Okay, all right, look, thank you very much indeed. I want to say thank you to Nink for hosting us. It's been brilliant this week. Thank you to our guests, Dave and Julian. Thank you so much indeed for coming to watch this live recording of the show. And you can give yourselves a big round of applause. Bye-bye.
Get show notes, the podcast archive, and free resources to boost your writing career at selfpublishingshow.com. Join our thriving Facebook group at selfpublishingshow.com/Facebook. Support the show at patreon.com/selfpublishingshow. And join us next week for more help and inspiration so that you can make your mark as a successful indie author. Publishing is changing, so get your words into the world and join the revolution with the Self-Publishing Show.